Up next, John Lott joins us. We're going to talk, of course, about the Department of Homeland Security buying all these millions of rounds of ammunition. California being struck down with concealed carry. This looks good for people who want to carry a gun. Much more with John Lott, 2 hours on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, John Lott Jr., president of the newly formed Crime Prevention Research Center. He is an economist who has held research and teaching positions at places such as the University of Chicago, Yale University, Stanford, UCLA. He was the chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during the 88 and 89 and is the author of many books, including More Gun, Less Crime. And we're here to talk for a couple hours with him about that on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, always a pleasure.
Oh, great to talk to you again.
Want to get your reaction first and foremost to the Department of Homeland Security purchasing 75 million rounds of ammo. Is that unusual? They say no.
Right. Well, they don't purchase. I mean, they could purchase a little bit every once in a while, but instead they wait and they purchase large amounts. They say that they can save some money doing it. And it sounds like a lot, but, you know, Department of Homeland Security has about 100,000 people who are law enforcement equivalent types. Many of them undergo extensive training each year. So, I mean, I'm not too concerned. I know some people have theories that they're doing it in order to drive up the price of ammunition. The way I look at it is gun owners probably shouldn't mind too much that they're going and buying this regularly over time, because it means that people who make ammunition will be making more profits and hopefully expand their production, and basically means a stronger industry in the long run.
John, some who think that this is a very sinister attempt to buy ammo, to use it on Americans, what do you think?
I'm not sure that that's going to be enough for them to control the United States. They're probably going to need a lot more ammunition than that. I mean, there are lots of things to be concerned about with the government. I don't think them using this ammunition on the general citizenry is at the top of the list.
But in terms of buying it, you would not be alarmed by this. This is normal?
I'm not alarmed by it, no. Yeah, I think it's normal.
Big story today at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is saying that the California right to carry, sounds pretty good for gun enthusiasts, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's a big, big change. They're essentially said that the current regulations that California has are unconstitutional. You read the Constitution, the Second Amendment says the right to keep and bear arms, and the Supreme Court's been very clear that bear means to carry. And so the court says, look, California, it's illegal to openly carry guns, and it's virtually impossible to go and obtain a concealed carry permit. And so they say you have to let them do one way or the other. You know, if California only banned open carry but allowed concealed carry for people, then that would be okay. Or if they banned concealed carry but allowed open, that would be fine. But they can't do both. And the way the rules are set up, where you have to show good cause that somehow you're in an unusual situation and just rule out self-defense as a justification for being able to carry, the court's very clear saying that that's not going to fly, that you can't have it so that only unusual cases allow people to be able to go and defend themselves. The court multiple times in its decision says it must be possible for the typical person to be able to go and obtain a permit if that's what they desire to do. And they also reference that 42 states have these types of objective rules in the country, and that it's basically time for California to join those other states.
Now, we saw what happened in Illinois. It was not really a great concealed carry program, a judge forcing the state, of course, to do this. You know, they're making you take tests and training, which is okay. I mean, people need to know how to handle the weapon that they buy and own, but I think they're being a little excessive in Illinois, and Illinois is not really using reciprocity with other states. What might California do? Will they allow other concealed weapons permit holders from other states to carry in California?
Well, my guess is initially they'll do something similar to Illinois, that they'll just try to make it as difficult as they possibly can given the court decision. So in Illinois, you're talking about a $150 fee to get a permit, plus 16 hours of training, plus range time included in there.
And no reciprocity.
No reciprocity. And so you're talking about, $700 probably thereabouts, at least $650, to go through the process to get a concealed handgun permit. And my guess is California will try to be at least as difficult. And then you're going to have other cases. I mean, I think the key in this appeals court decision is they talk about the typical person being able to do it. If you have those high fees, I think there's certain systematic discrimination that occurs. My research in More Guns, Less Crime and other places indicates the types of people who benefit the most from being able to carry a gun for protection primarily are the ones who are most likely to be victims of violent crime, and that tends to be poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas. You have a $700 fee for somebody to go and get a permit. Who do you think you're pricing out of being able to do
that? That's right. They're not going to be able to do that. They can't afford that.
And so I think they're going to try to be as difficult as they think they can get away with, but there'll be other court cases eventually to go and try to rein them in. Let me put it this way. The Supreme Court has spoken very clearly with regard to the First Amendment about restrictions that you can put on things like newspapers. So if California tomorrow tried to pass a one-penny tax that was aimed just at newspapers, the court would strike it down. In the 1920s, the court had a decision that said, with regard to tax on newspapers, it said you cannot tax a fundamental right. Well, the court's already made it very clear in a couple of Supreme Court decisions that you have a fundamental right to self-defense. The one thing that could throw a monkey wrench into all this is if you have another retirement or death on the Supreme Court. Both of those decisions were close decisions.
Yeah, good
point. 5-4 decisions. And this
one was 2-1, wasn't it?
Right. This was 2-1.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. One person goes, and that flips. And then
right.
you can lose
the gains that you already have. I mean, the president... we've seen the two Supreme Court justices he's appointed, they don't believe that there's an individual right to self-defense, and it's pretty clear he would appoint somebody else who would be similar, and that would dramatically change things.
Now, how will we see this unfold? I mean, how will people be able to track this to see what states California allow under reciprocity and how they're going to handle this? What do people do, John?
Well, the key thing is going to be in the next month, and that's going to be whether San Diego, the county of San Diego, appeals this decision. The way they can appeal it is two possibilities. They could go to the full appeals court in San Francisco and ask them to review this three-judge decision. It's called an en banc review that would occur at that point. The Ninth Circuit is well known for being one of the most liberal left-wing appeals courts in the country, and there's a chance that it could reverse it.
Wow.
The thing is, there's a split now among the different appeals courts, and so even if we lost at that point, there'd be a clear appeal to the Supreme Court, and I would think it'd be very likely that the court would take it up. And as I say, I think given the current makeup of the court, the odds are better than even that we would get it. The other possibility is that San Diego will just drop the appeal. And I don't think that's completely unlikely in the sense that gun control opponents may not want to have a case like this go to the Supreme Court, because I think this is a case where we would stand a particularly good chance of winning, because California has just been so restrictive. I think it'd be very difficult for the Supreme Court to go and uphold the current rules.
Would you say California has been one of the most restrictive gun control states in the nation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, here's the irony. We have an appeals court decision that says people have a fundamental right to be able to go and protect themselves, and that bear arms means what it says, that people are able to protect themselves even when they're outside their homes. And at the same time, you have California law, which is pretty much banning the sale of handguns. In the next couple of years, as the stocks of guns at gun stores disappear, this micro-stamping law that you have in effect, basically all the handgun manufacturers are saying it's impossible for them to comply with it. And so for any semi-automatic handgun, you're going to not see any sales of those in California. And so you have this ironic thing that's saying people have the right to be able to carry a handgun for protection, but another California law, which I'm sure is going to be challenged, is making it so there you can't sell semi-automatic handguns in the state.
John, when we come back, I want to get your take on this big push, of course, to try to scare people into not owning guns. And what's all behind that? Who's pushing it? And how successful is that? Our special guest for the next couple hours, John Lott, author of More Guns, Less Crime. His blog, of course, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. Later on in the program, Carla Willis Brandon joins us as we talk about contact from the afterlife. When we come back in a moment with John Lott, we'll be continuing to talk about the Second Amendment. Welcome back, John Lott, with us. John, how do people select the kind of research they read, either in newspapers or periodicals, when there's so much out there, some of it being financed by people who are against guns, against the Second Amendment? What are people to do?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question. You can't expect most people to take the time to look at the, you know, the research themselves. I mean, at the Crime Prevention Research Center, we try to put up critical evaluations of some of these studies, but there's so many that are coming out these days. You have Mayor Bloomberg just a little bit over, I guess, about a year and a quarter ago, he put up $250 million for the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to hire 40 new academics to primarily look at gun control issues. You have George Soros with his Open Society program, which is giving literally many tens of millions of dollars to finance these types of studies. About a year ago, you had Obama met with the heads of 23 large foundations that have been actively involved in the healthcare debate, kind of putting out studies over the years to kind of prepare the push for the type of increased government control that we've got now with Obamacare. And the president said, look, we've won the healthcare debate. It's time that we focus on another issue, and he got agreement from the heads of all these 23 large foundations like Kaiser and Wellness and others that have been deeply involved in the healthcare debate to go and use their massive resources to try to push gun control research. And then you have the federal government itself. You know, it's just an example. The president ignores existing laws. We've had a number of laws have been passed in 96 and 2003 and just again in 2011, which has restricted the type of research that the federal government can fund with regard to guns, simply because of the simple fact that it's been very difficult for the federal government to keep politics out of the research that it funds. And but the president is basically ignoring what that is and those types of restrictions. And you know, I don't think most people believe that he's going to be particularly objective in terms of the type of research that he's going to be spending federal tax dollars to go and fund. And so I suppose the simplest way to answer your question is to say, when if it's a public health study, I would pretty much discount it. And the reason is because the quality of the statistics in it is usually very poorly done. I'll give you a simple example.
Okay.
It's well known, and that is the claim about the risks of having guns in the home. These are the types of studies that go back maybe about 15 to 20 years. And what they would do is they would claim that the risk of you either killing yourself or a loved one is much greater than going and killing an attacker, somebody who threatens you or somebody else in your family. The way they would do these studies is they would look at people who died in a home over the course of a year and then ask the relatives of the deceased whether a gun was owned in the home. And then they would just assume that if you died from a gunshot and a gun was owned in the home, it was that gun that was used in the death.
Yeah.
When people have gone back, when criminologists and economists have gone back and looked at this, what they find is that, in fact, 86% of those deaths were due to weapons brought in from the outside, not a weapon that was owned in the home. And simply fixing that one fact reduced or completely reversed the claims that were there. Another example is that they would ignore the vast majority of defensive gun uses. So, for example, you only kill an attacker very, very rarely. Less than 1 out of every 1,000 times that people use a gun defensively is the attacker killed. Woundings are more frequent, but they're still rare. They're about 7 or 8 times more frequent than killing an attacker. But what that does is, in either of those cases, it ignores the huge number of times that simply brandishing a gun is able to cause a criminal to stop an attack. And it may not be as dramatic as killing the attacker, but it still produces the benefit in terms of protecting the victims that are there. And probably the most important problem is just they don't know how to deal with the issue of causation. So I've debated the people who have done these types of studies, and I said, look, let's use your methodology to go and study something like hospital care. So we'll look at people who died over the course of the year, and we'll ask their relatives whether the person had been to the hospital. And then they have these control groups for people who are the same age, sex, and race, who live within a mile of the deceased. And we'll ask those people whether they've been to the hospital. Well, if we do a regression, you know, a statistical test to see the relationship between whether you die and whether you've been to the hospital, my guess is you'd find a very strong positive relationship. But I hope nobody would believe that proves we should ban hospitals. And the reason is because there's a reason why people went to the hospital. It's because they were sick.
Yeah.
And you don't compare somebody who's sick to see whether they're more likely to die with somebody who was well and didn't even feel the need to go to the hospital. What you want to do is look at two people who are equally sick and to see if one went to the hospital and one didn't, what would happen to their mortality rate. And the same thing applies to guns, because there's a reason why some people own guns. Some people could be in gangs. Other people may be victims of crime in the past. They may have something that makes their home a particular target for crime. And just because you control for age, sex, and race, and whether people live within a mile of each other, doesn't mean you're going to be picking up all the factors that likely influence the odds of whether somebody's going to be a victim of a crime or not. And so the way an economist deals with these issues is that you look at prices. So, for example, was the hospital nearby your home shut down? Or was there some other factor that changed the probability that you would be a victim of a crime? The way the public health people deal with these issues is they just look to they act as if they're studying drugs. When you look at the efficacy of drugs, you have a control. You can make somebody take a placebo. You know, they sign up for the test.
Yeah.
But they don't have any control whether they get the real drug or they get the placebo. If we were to do that in real life for these policy issues, you'd make somebody own a gun whether they want to or not. And somebody else who wants to own a gun may not be able to because you've randomly chosen whether or not they can do so. Now, that would be fine. But that's not the way. They don't run these types of tests the same way they run studies of drug efficacy. And my concern is that there's so much bad stuff that's coming out there that's being used deliberately to try to scare people. So I'll just give you a simple example. We just had ABC News just had a whole day where every news show that they had talked about the risks of having guns in the home. And they talked about the fact that in 2009, there were 7,300 gun firearm injuries in the United States. The problem is they would be talking about firearm injuries for children. And they would never tell you that about 76% of these involve 17, 18, 19-year-olds, that well over 60% of those involved assaults from violent crimes, firearm injuries resulting from that. Nor did they mention that, unfortunately, that young black males who are 17, 18, 19 years of age have a 13-fold higher rate of firearm injuries than white males of the same age.
13 times more?
Right.
Amazing.
Look, we have all these factors basically are saying we have a drug gang problem in the United States.
We sure do.
And you and I have talked about this before. And look, any type of injury is tragic. I'd rather none of them happen. But the thing is, to go and take these drug gang cases and somehow scare people, law-abiding citizens, into not owning guns because they think these are cases of young children getting a hold of guns and accidentally firing them is absolutely bizarre. I mean, making it so law-abiding citizens don't own guns isn't going to have a damn effect on drug gangs fighting against each other over drug turf. And, you know, but what's missed in all this is that when you scare law-abiding citizens into not owning guns, then they can't defend themselves. And so when you have criminals, you have to see a couple things. When people can't access guns for self-defense, criminals become emboldened to go and attack people in their homes, and they become more successful in the violent crimes that they commit against people. And when you scare people into not owning guns, you actually increase the death rate.
You increase the death rate. How come?
Well, because you make it so that people can't defend themselves.
All right.
And that criminals know, when they know that victims can't defend themselves, they're more willing to break into a home. I'll give you a simple example.
Easy prey.
Exactly. You wouldn't put a sign in front of your home that says your home is a gun-free zone.
No.
And the answer is obviously why. You're not scaring the criminal off. It's not like the criminal says, geez, I was going to rob this home, but since I'm not allowed to take my gun in there, I can't go in there. I'll go someplace else. In fact, the opposite thing happens. If you have two homes next to each other, one has a sign saying it's a gun-free zone, the other one doesn't, we know which one the criminal is going to break in. Nobody puts a sign like that in front of their home. Even strong gun control proponents. You know, there's an irony. About a year ago, there was this newspaper near New York City that got a hold of a database and published the list of everybody who owned guns who had gone through the registration process in New York. And there was a huge outcry. They eventually took it down. But one interesting thing happened. There was an enterprising group of young people who went to the homes of the editors of the newspaper and kind of secretly taped asking, would they put a sign in their yard saying that they were that they did not own a gun and that they were proudly non-gun owners? And none of the executives would put up a sign like that in front of their home, even though they said they all agreed that people shouldn't own guns. But they also told the, and it was on the video, they said the reason why they were afraid, they actually understood this, the reason why they were afraid was they were worried they would give criminals the wrong message.
Well, you know, and what's ironic, too, people who have alarm systems will do the opposite, John. They'll stick stickers and signs that say,
you know, people,
we've got an alarm system here.
Right, or they'll put a sign on their door that says, you know, protected by Smith & Wesson or something.
Exactly. Exactly. That is a deterrent, I think, and the same thing with having a gun. In California, for example, because it does not have, very lax gun laws for people, is crime higher in this state than others?
Yeah, it's higher than it would have been. Look, there are lots of factors that affect what the crime rate is. It's hard just to make a simple comparison. What you have to look at is how things change before and after you have different types of regulations there. And I think it's very clear. It's just not California, but it's the rest of the nation. In fact, it's the world. When you go and you see rules that are more restrictive, making it harder for individuals to go and defend themselves, you see increases in crime relative to what you would have otherwise seen. And look, I'm an economist. People often ask, why does an economist go and look at crime issues? And it's economics is based on a simple notion that if something becomes more costly, people do less of it. Or if there's a greater return, they do more. And crime is no different. If you make it costly for criminals to go and commit crimes, if you make it risky for them to go and do that, they do less of it. They switch into other things. So when you see concealed handgun permits being issued in a place or more being issued, you see criminals change their behavior in lots of ways. One is some are less likely to go and come into contact with victims when they have when they're able to carry. Some switch into other types of crime. So you have crimes involving direct contact between the victim and the criminal. Those we classify as violent crimes. Rather than robbing somebody face-to-face, maybe what they do is they try to steal unattended cars or they break into homes where nobody's there. Another way criminals change their behavior is some of them move out of the area. And so if you look at counties that are on opposite sides of state borders, the counties in the state that passes a concealed handgun law sees a drop in violent crime. At the same time, the bordering county on the other side of the state line, which is in a state without right to carry, will see a small increase.
That's right.
Right at the same time, some of them move. And, there are other changes that you see, too. So you see changes differently across different types of violent crime. So when states pass right to carry laws, you see a particularly large drop in mass public shootings compared to murders generally.
And you know what? And in most states that have concealed carry, the rank-and-file police officers, John, they favor this. They favor your right to carry a concealed weapon. It's their police chiefs and bosses and mayors who do not. Why that disparity?
Well, there is a disparity, but you see both groups support it. It's just that street officers overwhelmingly, there's a poll done last year by an organization called Police One. It's by far the largest organization of police officers in the United States. They have about 450,000 members. 380,000 of them are active duty police officers, and the other 70,000 are retired. Just to give you an idea, there are about 700,000 active police officers in the United States. So this is more than half belong to this organization. And they did a survey of their members, and over 91% of them supported right to carry laws.
Huge.
It's huge. And you look at, there's two different associations for police chiefs. There's one called the National Association of Police Chiefs, which has about 3,000 members. And then you have the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which has about 100 members. About 75 of them are Americans, and the rest are foreigners. The larger of the two groups is more conservative. You'll find in surveys of their members, about 75% or so support concealed carry, and they support and they think concealed carry is extremely important for reducing crime. For the International Association of Police, you'll see a majority of their members oppose it. But in those cases, you can't tell how many of those are foreigners that make up of the poll there. And so, but you know, one other question that was very interesting, it's you can go through the whole survey for Police One. It's, you know, all these different gun control laws that get so much attention. Police who have experience with these things know that these things don't work, whether they're assault weapons bans or limits on magazine size. You'll see 70, 80, 90% of police officers think that they will have no benefit or actually be counterproductive. And here's the thing. Police officers know, and you can see this in the surveys, the benefits to themselves of having guns.
That's right. John, stay with us. We're going to talk more about this. A few more questions for you, and then we'll take some phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.